Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Well, well, well. Shopping for a car?
Yep. Carvana made financing a car as smooth as can be.
Oh, yeah?
I got pre-qualified instantly and had real terms personalized just for me.
Doesn't get much smoother than that.
Well, I got to browse thousands of car options on Carvana, all within my budget.
Doesn't get much smoother than that.
It does. I actually wanted a car that seemed out of my range, but I was able to add a cosigner and found my dream car.
It doesn't get much...
Oh, it gets smoother. It's getting delivered tomorrow.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to get pre-qualified today.
You're listening to Pop, the History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
Welcome to part two. Later on, Marcus Veer from Living in a Box talks about his amazing Kids Trucks TV success, the new lineup of the band as they prepare for more gigs, and about the highs and lows of the band. But first, at the end of episode one, Living in a Box had just signed a record deal and immediately went off to the States. Well, what happened to Marcus and the guys in LA? Doesn't always stay in LA.
I mean, you know, I think we'd arrived with a tour manager who'd come from the management company with us, who literally introduced us to some girls that he used to know at the Cat and Fiddle, which is the English pub in Hollywood at the time. And we arrived knowing nobody, and we left, and we threw a party for over 500 people about 6 months later. So we got very much into the scene. You know, here are three English boys with English accents who've just got a record deal. I mean, we weren't manhole cover designers. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, if you're going to Hollywood, you want to be in the business. I would hate to just go there as a punter. I mean, you are, you know what it's like. And everybody wants to know who you are. Okay, you haven't got a record out yet, but here are these three English kids have got a hot record deal, and they're recording in Hollywood, and they've got, you know, $1,000 a week per diems each, and they've got a car, a flash car to drive around in, and a nice apartment. It's like, well, what's not to like, you know? So we were invited to virtually every party. We were Living in a Box, I think it was probably more an happy, a better name for us. So we were at every opening. We went to the Chanel's house, which had a river running through it. We went to Sammy Davis Jr.'s place, to his party.
What was that like?
We invited up to the Magic Castle, you know, where they do all the, where that's all based up there. You know, and we got into a real scene. And I can remember there was a club called the 2020 Club, and there were all these artists would play. The house band was Earth, Wind & Fire, if you can imagine that. Prince would get up and do a track. Chaka Khan would get up and do a track. And it's just like, God, you know, is this actually happening? And, you know, of course, the musicians that we'd all seen on record labels, Paulinho da Costa on, you know, on albums, or, you know, whoever, you know, there was loads of them. You know, we used the backing singers from Luther Vandross's band, and we used the Sea Wind Horns from Earth, Wind & Fire. It was just like, yeah, you know, this is amazing. You know, this is absolutely insane.
I mean, one of the really fascinating things about what the record company did is that they pushed you in a sense with a sense of anonymity.
Totally.
So could you just tell me about that?
Well, yeah, again, possibly another mistake. I mean, I think one of the first mistakes, and I would advise against anybody using an eponymous band name. So Living in a Box by Living in a Box. We couldn't come up with a name. We just couldn't. We probably should have worked a bit harder and flippantly went, ugh. And they went, why don't you call you Living in a Box by Living in a Box? Which is great in terms of drumming the first hit through. But when you start going Living in a Box, Room in Your Heart, Living in a Box, Blow the House Down, it's like, oh, what? And I'm sure Big Country maybe have had the same problem and others. So that wasn't ideal. What was the question again?
That you were pushed with a sense of anonymity. You know, right. You were almost like a black band from America, but you weren't.
Well,
you
that was three white that guys. That was another sort of clever little marketing ploy. So we had the weird thing with the band name. The second thing is with Living in a Box, the first single, they wanted to put out the 12-inch Arthur Baker mix out on a white label by mailing it in from New York with a New York stamp on it to all the clubs in the UK so that the UK DJs thought we were an American band. And it was at that time there was so much going on in the music scene in New York and the underground dance scene that it was just cool to be, you know, coming from the States. They probably would I think they hedged it and then, well, if they're three white middle class white boys from Sheffield, you know, does anybody care? We've got an absolute monster on our hands. But if we don't know who they are, it's totally anonymous. It's mailed in from New York. Maybe they'll play the record. And they did. It went number one club, which was a great springboard then to people like, the radio DJs and go on to radio from the club scene, like Tony Blackman and so on, as we talked about. But, you pay a price for that anonymity because they want to think it then sort of, well, we were seeing Curiosity Kill the Cat all over the front page of Just 17 magazine or whoever else. And we weren't doing any of this. Richard, of course, was the most sort of publicity shy pop star that's ever existed in humanity, and actually was quite happy to not have any images or be doing photo shoots or all that kind of thing. Titch and I sort of went along with it. We just thought, well, this is fine. But, you know, after a while, even to this day, people don't really know what Living in a Box looked like. I mean, we could walk out on stage, hey, it's Living in a Box, and they go, yeah, it's like, oh, right, oh yeah, sort of, and it's a bit of a weird one. But I don't know whether it's a good or a bad thing, to be honest. It's just the way it was for us.
I think there's a positive side to it as well, because being in the public eye, although, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, sort of see that as an ideal, that they would like to be well known, they'd like to be, you know, famous in some sort of way. Being in the public eye does have a side to it that isn't that comfortable.
Oh, yeah.
So maybe that was also something that allowed you to have a private life as well.
Well, I think so. I mean, we would just do the interviews that we thought we wanted to do, that were not particularly pop orientated. So we do some more of the music tech magazines, or we do The Face or Q magazine. That was in the UK, and other territories they took the handbrake off completely. And I remember in Japan it was madness. I mean, they, you know, would split us up when we would fly over to Japan, and we wouldn't see each other for 3 days because we would all be doing separate photo shoots, separate interviews, separate TV interviews, so they could maximize the amount of time that we were there. Italy a little bit like that, and then there were occasions when it was police outrider protection and all this kind of nonsense. So, yeah, I think you're right. I mean, we could walk around Notting Hill having a great old time and just, watch ourselves on Top of the Pops. You go out, nobody know who you were. I mean, Top of the Pops probably was the first time they were like, ah, that's what they look like. But, of course, by that time, you've got a top five record. And everybody going, yay, this is great. But I never knew there were three white kids from Sheffield. In fact, I think up on Wikipedia had us down from Manchester up until about the week before last when somebody kindly changed it. Although Richard was originally from Stockport, so maybe they got it from there. But, yeah, the anonymity thing never really bothered us that much. But it's a bit of a weird one sometimes when people don't know who you are.
I bet it was one of those people who were putting up the posters from Manchester back then who wrote that Wikipedia entry.
Yeah,
let's piss you off after all these years. I mean, you said that, and I think that's an interesting point about Living in a Box, because it's Living in a Box and the Living in a Box track, and that you
get
known for one thing.
Living in a Box album as well.
Yeah, you made some fantastic tracks at that time. Do you think then that really was part of the reason, or you mentioned the record company and the record company not being able to, Chrysalis not really being able to promote like Room in Your Heart in America, whereas it was a hit in Britain, wasn't it?
was a hit all over the world. I mean, it's one of the biggest songs. I mean, just even in terms of what, when you see your PRS and you see where things are being played and the longevity that song has had, it's probably the song I'm most proud of. And it was a big record everywhere except the States, when I think they managed to get it to 67 or something. And of course, by this stage, when you're looking, you know, obviously we were not in LA on a freebie, you know, you're paying for that. You could really do with recouping from the whole world and making sure that every territory is doing the best to make to sell your records. And when I think we'd gone over on some unfortunate West Coast promo tour in the States, and they just tanked Room in Your Heart. And I remember Richard being like so fed up. It's like, what are we doing, guys? I mean, you know, the bill is huge. We're doing well everywhere. We've always wanted to have some success. We worked with Albert Hammond on Room in Your Heart, and he, you know, was having hits that were just absurd. You know, I mean, he'd written the Olympic theme for Whitney Houston. He'd written To All the Girls I Loved Before, and started with Little Arrows and ended up in, you know, yeah, just writing hit after hit. Tina Turner, you know, go on and on and on. Aswad had that big hit, Don't Turn Around. He'd written that. So he was well used to having hits. And when we'd finished, I finished with him writing Room in Your Heart. He said, my God, this is probably my favorite record that I think I've probably ever written. And for a guy like that to then be told that Chrysalis Records had fumbled it to number 67, it's like, what are we doing?
Was that why Richard came out of the band? The 5 years were up, and you were recording the third album, I believe. Was there a particular moment? Well, there must have been a particular moment where it ended. Do you remember that moment and what exactly happened?
Yeah, I mean, Richard has sort of made noises to us before about, you know, and I couldn't disagree with it. It was like, listen, we're getting on fine. We love each other and we're having a great time. And the musical aspects of what we're doing were very converged. I think there was two forces at play. One, which we've just gone over, which is the issue in the States. The second one was that Richard definitely wanted to get more songwriting of his songs on the record. And I'd written the hits. And so therefore I was principally earning the most money out of it, to be brutally honest with you. And I think Richard always felt, look, I'm fronting this. I'm singing your songs and I really want more songwriting. And Richard's songwriting center was much more AOR, middle of the road, than where mine was. And so I said, Richard, you know, obviously trying to appease to a certain degree, well, let's do some more stuff like you would do. And then suddenly Living in a Box starts to become something else. And I think at that point, I was beginning to resist how far we would go into going where Richard wanted to go musically. And Richard just said, look, I think we're going to have to call it a day. And then let's get also brutal money-wise. Whenever any artist signs a record deal, they are signed jointly and severally. And I think Richard was picking up, if he left the band, Chrysalis got first choice. Because obviously they've spent all the money getting Living in a Box to where they are. Richard is a name to some degree. And they give him, you know, they were going to give him a big check, which they ended up doing. And so he managed to short circuit ever having to put anything out. He gets a big lump of cash. He gets to do a solo album and we lose our singer. And I said to him at the time, I said, Richard, not even Mick Jagger has managed to leave the Stones and have a successful solo career. George Michael has just done it, but you're going to count the numbers of artists, Steve Winwood probably, but very few, who leave a band environment, solo artist, and go solo and have a successful career. And he went, I probably am making the biggest mistake, but I'm going to do it anyway. And I went, okay, what can I do?
I mean, in that sense, he left you, for a better sort of phrase, he left you a little bit in the shit. You know, you'd had these 5 years of massive success and those 5 years, and I don't think they do define you because we'll come to that later, but these 5 years in that sense at that time had defined who you were. So how did you, I know that you carried on songwriting, but how did you feel emotionally at that time about your life?
Well, I remember saying to him, and every artist would agree with this, you need luck. It doesn't matter how good you are, you need some luck, but you work for that luck. You create your own luck, but you need it. And we'd had our break. We'd got Living in a Box away. We were a brand name to some extent. You know, it's like trying to find that again is really bloody hard, you know. So it was bad times. It was like, well, Jesus, what do we do now? And would I have done anything differently? Would I have just quickly replaced him with somebody? The record company, of course, by that stage, are all going, whoa, shit. You know, we've got a solo artist, so we're just paid more money for that. So Living in a Box, we're not really interested in what you've got to say. And I was a bit burnt from the whole thing and just thought, I'm just not going to do anything for now. I actually don't know what to do. I mean, there are points in life, aren't there, when we go, I don't know what to do. You know, we've all played clever. Oh, yeah, this is all a good idea and this is always a plan. No, I just did not know what to do next. So there were a couple of years, really, more than a couple of years, where I just sort of, I'd met other songwriters that I wrote some songs for other artists, wrote some more songs with Albert Hammond. And without the vehicle to write for, it soon became really apparent that personally, for me, I am not a jobbing songwriter for hire. I admire the guys who are, who can go around and they can read a brief and they can drop a song on and it'll be absolutely spot on. It will be a hit. I am not that guy. I need to be writing songs for me, for my band to do my thing with my ideas. And personally, to me, I can't go out and write a 3-minute pop song for an artist I have no connection with, you know. So that was a very strange time, really, and sort of ended me in the career for about, I suppose I was in the wilderness probably for about 8 years, I should imagine, before I decided that I wanted to do something else, you know.
You're listening to Pop, the History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
I think that's interesting. It's fascinating that you say 8 years, because when I lost my career and I'd come to Germany, ran a TV channel, lost my career, it was 10 years before I could sit up again and do something else.
Right.
But I look back at that time and I say that completely defined who I am today. And thank God that happened. How do you look back at that dark period? And when did it start changing again? Because I know that you've really moved on into something which is also wonderfully successful.
Well, I think, you know, it does take, you know, you're stunned for a while. And certainly if you're a creative, being stunned, as you will know, is not ideal. It's not like we are accountants and we can go and add some more sums up. You know, it really completely wrecks your emotional center and takes a while to sort of put the pieces back together. And so, you know, I met my wife, we moved on, had a family. I experimented with all sorts of other different things that I wanted to look at, but always came back to music, because at the end of the day, that's what I do. And I love doing it. And I wanted to find a new way to express myself musically where I could retain my control that I just referred to. So I'm writing for a vehicle, for a project that is mine in entirety, in my own control. And I found it once my kids were very young, with the Little Big TV project and Kids Trucks TV, as it's now become. And now we're doing a new series of animation. And that's just grown because I'm a control freak, right? I mean, I just love being able to be totally responsible for things. And that was the problem, I think, in those wilderness years where, I just get pulled from pillar to post. And, my pub should be dropping with these individuals, and nothing really worked for me. I had to take control and find a new creative project. And the industry had changed. So let's not forget, as you well know, the digital revolution, for better or worse, came into play. So what you did as an artist and how you could earn money from it completely collapsed in around 2000. You know, YouTube became a thing, but, you know, sort of certain technologies converged to get me excited about what I could possibly do as an independent without having to sign a record deal and sign my life away. I could do it completely off my own bat. And by the mid to late 2000s, it was a sustainable business model to basically make your own programs, which I ended up doing educational programs for kids.
What sort of triggered that? The actual idea, I know you wanted to find something, but what actually triggered this particular thing?
Two things. Having a 3-year-old son who stood absolutely aghast every time a tractor went by, or a bus, or a bin lorry, or a digger. You know, it was just like, you know, almost shaking with excitement. And I thought, well, that's an interest, you know, and they all do it. You know, they still do it. Machines, as they will tell you in kids' telly, are king, you know. And my wife, who's from Boston in the States, had just come back from Boston, and her brother, who lives over there, had just bought a VHS of a locked-off camera on a building site, which I think was like number one in the US video chart. And it obviously cost about 30p to put together. And it was shocking. It was awful. But my son loved it. And Tish said to me, well, why don't we do something with your music? Put some songs in it, put a little character in it, or maybe we can get some guys to film some tractors going up and down a field. And so it was her idea. And I thought, well, this sounds great. And we know we've got a ready-made audience in our kids that are at home, you know, ready to sample test it.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And so we thought, well, we're living in Chiswick. There aren't many tractors going up and down Chiswick High Road. Better get on the phone and see if we can get some tractor action going. We'll start with tractors. So we phoned up John Deere, who happened to be probably the biggest agricultural machinery company in the world, and blagged about £4.5 million worth of kit in Suffolk. They never asked the question if I'd done this before. Lucky break. Because the answer would have been no. Or I might have blagged it, actually might have blagged it. But anyway, they went, yeah, sure. Well, if you want to film some stuff, there's some machinery in Suffolk we're on that's on test with some farmers. So we got a mate who got a camera. We stood in the field. We filmed the tractors going up and down. And then we thought, well, let's film a farmer and try and get a little bit of a storyline. You know, and I was trying to remember all those shows that I used to watch as a kid that had got that sort of slightly mom and pop, really nice sort of warm feel, but educational. Then I'll start writing a song. So I wrote Here Comes a Tractor, which became this sort of phenomenon. And then we called the show Here Comes a Tractor. And we did Here Comes a Fire Engine, Here Comes a Digger, Here Comes a Train. And they went off. And I remember putting it up on YouTube. Nothing happened for about 6 months. In fact, we'd sold them physically on DVDs just before DVDs then passed on and YouTube came its thing. And anyway, on YouTube, nothing happened for about 6 months. 50 views, 500 views, 5,000 views. Oh, okay. And I didn't look at it for about, I don't know, 9 months, 1 million views, 2 million views, 5 million, 15 million. It was like, oh, my God, what's happening? And then, of course, the revenue stream starts to come in. The songs we started to put on, you know, Spotify and Apple Music. And then we got this huge fan base, which was just unbelievable. So I got the magic back.
What do you think that you needed from the business acumen that you must have learned from being a pop star in, you know, from 85 to 90 and having all that success and suffering sort of those failures along the way, as it were, from the record company? What do you think you learned from that time which has made you make the right decisions for this project?
Well, I think, again, there's a little bit of luck and you know, let's be honest, as you're moving from an analog world selling a physical project to a digital world selling a digital product, that has to exist for me to have been able to do what I did. So that the lay of the land had to be right. And in terms of business, well, you know, you're always looking at a model in terms of trying to work out how much it is it's going to cost you to film this stuff. So relatively cheaply, and also what revenue streams you're going to get. And I didn't really know what revenue streams we were going to get because I didn't know how many streams you'd need to be able to get some income going on YouTube and what you could do with it. And the power that you would have with it and developing subscribers and a fan base, essentially, that you can say anything to and talk to and communicate and involve in the brand. So I don't know. There are similarities. It's distribution is king, isn't it? It always has been, you know, for artists to try and get their music out there, their artwork out there, or whether it's NFTs now with people doing artwork, or whether it's, you know, Bitcoin and understanding how that works and blockchain and blah, 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 blah. So YouTube, social media, Instagram, so on and so forth. These are all sort of things that I found just naturally very easy to understand and work with, mainly because I've worked with computers and everything from sequencers right through to mixing desks. And so technologically, I understood how it worked. And it was not something I was afraid of. I think what was really nice, as I come back to, is that I could control all the content completely. And as we're working to now to start working with animation and understanding how that works and to change the characters and take this project further into something even bigger and books and, you know, all the stuff that you can do in kids' entertainment. That is the new frontier for me and what I'm going to be involved in for the next 5 or 10 years, you know, and I love it. Even though my kids are now at university, but I mean, you know, I'm still tuned into it.
What's the success of Here Comes A, the central factor in you being able to allow yourself to say, okay, why not let's go back on stage? Why not let's reform in inverted commas and be back on stage as Living in a Box? I believe you've done sort of one performance in 2004, but actually to sort of come back as a reformation of Living
well,
in a Box.
Well, there was two. In 2004 was our performance where Richard joined the band. I mean, he came back in. It hadn't worked out for Richard. He got so disillusioned with the music industry, even more so when he got it. Even, you know, I think he found out how hard it really is. And I think you'd have to ask him, but I think there probably would be regrets there that we were there. You know, we were known. If we got a record company who was making a third album, we should have given it a go. But it didn't work out that way. It didn't work out for Richard once he'd left the band. And so it was quite an easy when we were offered this tour, which was an arena tour. In 2004, I said to him, look, do you want to do it? And he went, well, why not? And we got together and it was great. We really enjoyed it. Richard had made it very clear to me at that stage that although he'd enjoyed it, he's still one of the most nervous performers with this incredible voice and incredible ability to play guitar. It's just astounding to me that he's so terrified, but he didn't feel that he wanted to do it anymore. Some years later, we were offered tours and we go out now and do all the Rewinds and the Let's Rocks, and we still do those, and we're doing some more this year. So we've been touring, doing the sort of, if you like, a hobby thing, which all the artists do, I suppose. Maybe they're topping up their pension pots, and we don't get enough money to do that, but we love doing it. I mean, I think in the day, we didn't do much live work because of MTV. We were basically spending more on a video than a live tour. Technologically, it was also a bit tricky because we were using so many sequences and it wasn't as easy as it is now to transfer that. But anyway, the live thing is very much something that I'm hoping we can right the wrong of never really doing it much in the day, in the moment, and do quite a bit of late now, doing these wonderful 80s tours, which are, you know, all over the place. And we're very much part of that.
Was it a difficult decision at the beginning, though? Because obviously Richard wasn't a part of this, you know, what you're currently doing, and that's also changed again, but actually like looking for a new vocalist and playing into that is the fact of the anonymity in the past, in a sense.
Well, yeah.
May have played into the fact that you can be successful with a different vocalist.
Well, this is true. I mean, that is the one upside, as I say, is the anonymity in terms of being able to walk the streets at the time when everything was happening for us was one thing. Many, many decades later, because nobody's really quite sure. I mean, the real diehard fans obviously know Richard's music inside out, and there was always some kind of phobia about, well, can you imagine trying to replace? I mean, for me personally, I had to get over the fact, well, you know, Richard was so much of a distinctive voice with that booming Michael McDonald versus James Brown edge. You know, I mean, it's like, I mean, how are we going to replace that? And then once I got over the fact that we weren't going to replace it, you know, not usurp it in a way. Let's do something else with Living in a Box. Let's. Why does it need to be specifically that era? It could be anything. We could move on. We could even do new music. That's another conversation. But let's see who's around. And we were offered all these amazing gigs, which we turned down year after year after year. And Richard Titch and I were going, well, bloody hell, we should. You know, we're not going to be here forever. If we're going to do it, let's do it. Let's find somebody. I said, well, we're going to need a singer, dude. You know, well, let's see who we've got. And I just went through my mind, people that I've met who I thought were never going to be possibly how Richard was, but would give a good account of themselves and possibly take it somewhere else. And there's nothing wrong with that. And many artists, as we know, from Queen to Wet, 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 to, you know, loads of them have changed their lead singers. It's just the way of the world, and it can be very successful. So Kenny Thomas's name came into my head, and we've been stable mates at Chrysalis Records called Tempo, and I'd known the stuff that he'd done, and I thought, well, he hasn't got the bite and the oomph necessarily that Richard's got, but he has got the soul, and that's really crucial. So I phoned him up and said, listen, this might sound a bit mad, but we've got some gigs coming up. Do you want to be part of Living in a Box for the gigs? And he went, let me think about it. Next day, he phoned me up, went, yeah, absolutely. You know, I love it. I said, these are the songs we're going to do. He said, oh, Room in Your Heart, sing a song, man. I've got to sing that song. I've always wanted to sing. I used to dance around my bedroom singing that song. To actually sing it to a big audience would be just awesome. And we did, and we did it for 3 years. And we had the most hilarious time. I don't know whether you know Kenny, but he is a bit of a comedian. In fact, if his music business ever fails him any further, then he can have a great career in stand-up. But we had a great laugh, and it was really fun. And it was brilliant to get all the songs back together again and do a bit of Kenny music and a little bit of Living in a Box. And I think people were a bit like, this will be interesting. Living in a Box featuring Kenny Thomas. How's that going to work? But once we'd got there and the promoter saw it, they went, shit, this works really well. This really goes really, really well. And we do a couple of covers to Living in a Box and Kenny Thomas. And there's a couple of shows up on YouTube, and Live at Lytham, if you look at Living in a Box and Kenny Thomas, that's a bloody good show with a good video, and you can hear it working really well, really well. It's brilliant.
But Kenny's now moved on.
Yes, and Kenny moved on.
And who are you working with now, and why did you choose this
person? So Kenny wanted, you know, we had lockdown and it's tough for everybody. Kenny's been always more of a working musician, has never really stopped. Whereas, as we've been describing with Living in a Box, that's not the case. We've only really dipped our toes back in the live scene relatively recently. And he was offered the opportunity to make a new solo album and to do a tour because it was the 35th anniversary or the 30th anniversary of Voices. I can't remember. Decades have gone by. And so schedule-wise, we were starting to get off the dates. So I was going, Kenny, we got to this day. And we were like, I can't do it. And this one was like, oh, now we've got a real problem here. So we just decided mutually it was best that Kenny went off and did his thing. And with our blessings, fine, it's all good. But then again, it's like, oh, I've been here before. How many singers can a band have? But again, because we were fairly enigmatic, not so much of a problem. And I'd spoke to a few people, Martin Ware being principally one of them, Martin Fry being another one, who are very close friends, and said, look, I don't want to make a tit of myself. I'm not going to go out trying to drag this smelly old thing around with me and drag it around the clubs and fields of event world. If it's not going to work, I'm not going to flog it to death. I'll just call it a day. I care, but I'm not going to try and drag all the good things that we've done over the years down by just finding anybody who can do anything. And the name Brian J. Chambers came up from both of them, mainly from Martin Ware, who'd worked with a couple of backing singers who I'd also worked with, who'd worked with him when we did a show to raise some money for Kenny's daughter, which I organized for Kenny, and got involved with all the 80s artists that I'd worked with over the years, and Beverly Knight. And Beverly Knight is a good old friend of Kenny's, and Brian Chambers works a lot with Beverly. And so I'd spoken to her about, and it had just become a sort of like, this is the name that seems to be cropping up all the time. And then I got on the internet, as you do, before I contact him, and have a look at what he's done. And I saw his show with Pink Floyd at Pompeii, and he took a couple of lead vocals. I saw the duet that he did with Beverly Knight at the Royal Variety Show, or was a show at the Palladium, I think, in London. And it was just like, oh, this is another Richard. In a way, he's got the power and he's got the grit and the punch, and he, you know, he's worked with everybody. I mean, he's just a brilliant session guy, but has also worked, you know, the house scene back in the 90s as a solo act, and ended up in Butlins at 2 o'clock in the morning getting the audience going. So you know he can do that as well. So I asked him, and he thankfully, he thought about it again for a bit and then said, well, why not? Let's do it. So we're going to go out this summer with Brian taking over the lead vocals, and it should be, from what I've heard from our rehearsals, absolutely full on.
Fantastic. Now, you mentioned, obviously, all the way through Titch, who must be a close friend of yours because you've had this close relationship all, you know, throughout the years. Martin Ware, who I know is a close friend of yours. Martin Fry, ABC, who you wrote songs for on Lexicon Love 2, I think.
And, that's correct.
And he's a close friend. Now, I know that some of you go away on holiday together. What is it about this group of all have been and successful in their life, and all have been musicians in their life? What is it that what you have that connects you, or is it something else that sort of deeply connects you? I mean, I think Sheffield is probably a connection as well.
Well, obviously. I mean, I didn't know, I wasn't in a position to know that I knew of them in Sheffield as like bow down to the great ones who had broken through the cellophane line and were all over my television on a Thursday night or whenever it was for Top of the Pops at the time. So it wasn't really until I'd moved to London that I ever, that I met these guys, which is really strange. I never actually exchanged a word with them in Sheffield because I'd be watching them do a gig and they would be like the gods, you know. So I'd met them in Sheffield because, you know, you just do as you're doing the circuit. And, you know, they were a bit before Living in a Box, but still. And we just hit it off really, really well. And I've been on holidays with Martin Fry and Julie, his wife. And in fact, I had lunch with them about 3 or 4 days ago. We still see a lot of each other. Martin Ware is part of a group that do, as you say, go around on my boys' trip, which we do every year. We're going to San Sebastian in Spain on a culinary foodie thing, and Bilbao is going to see the Guggenheim. We're going in a couple of weeks. And they are all from the north, or, you know, in the music industry, and it is a bit like a busman's holiday. I mean, it really is. We just potter about and talk about the days and the music industry and what we're all doing now. And, you know, Martin is an octopus of tentacles that go out into all sorts of different things, from whether it's his 3D sound installations to all sorts of other. He's never shy of a project. So I'm usually sitting there in awe listening to what the next thing is, where he's become a professor of this or a whatever it is of that. And we've just become really good buddies, you know, really, really good buddies. You know, he's the godfather to my son JJ, and, you know, we have just been mates for all these years. And as Sheffield Wednesday fans, we go and see them play whenever we can. He's died in the wall, Sheffield Wednesday. And we just, I don't know, it's weird, isn't it? But we've just become solid buddies, solid.
Now, when I started this podcast interview with you, I said, you know, that you played an important role for me during the 80s because of your music, and plus of someone being on MTV, you know, your videos were on, you know, high rotation a lot of the time. So, in essence, that fed into my life during that era. What fascinated me when I went out to the local cafe, actually, this morning, and someone asked me, oh, what are you doing today? And I said, oh, I'm interviewing Marcus Veer, no reaction, Living in a Box. Oh, Living in a Box, you know, immediately. And they are under 30.
Right.
And it's amazing. There's something about Living in a Box which connects different generation. I think it's probably actually that 80s music somehow connects a lot of people. But what do you think it is? Is it because you were on different soundtracks? You're on games soundtrack?
Well, you're right. I mean, wherever I go in the world, you know, you're sitting by a pool somewhere, you get to know someone over a couple of cheeky beers, and they might say, well, what do you do, when they picked up the courage to ask the impudent question? And you say, oh, I was in the pop group. And they'll, you can see them mulling it over their head. They could be from anywhere. I was recently in Mexico, for example. And they'll go, anybody we know? And I'll go, well, how old are you? And they'll go, well, I'm whatever I am. And I go, well, I was in a band called Living in a Box. And they go, what? What? I've been living in a cardboard box. And it's like, yeah, it is that. And then again, maybe another upside to the eponymous nature of it, because if I said we were in the Doohickeys and we had a song called Living in a Box, well, maybe, I don't know. But anyway, so it is really, really well known. But I think in terms of young audiences, first of all, who are, by the way, I know my kids are, but then of course they'd have to be. Age is still, even my kids' mates are big into the 80s. They're really, really big into the 80s. And I think they can hear and smell and feel all that we felt about the individual nature of that music and how different it is. But what fantastic songs and great sounds and risk-taking that went on in terms of the records that went on. Also, because of Grand Theft Auto 5, which Living in a Box was included in their Grand Theft Auto 5, which was in 2013, became the second biggest selling video game of all time. And that's quite something. And you know, so you jump in a car and you smash into some grannies pushing prams, and you can turn the radio on in the car and Living in a Box will come on. So you are talking about, 150 million selling product that's introduced our music to that generation. So for sure, a lot of fan base that we get on our socials or stuff that goes through the website and emails are going, oh, I just got in the car and I really got into your song, Living in a Box. We've just got into the first album and Gate Crashing. We're also getting into that as well. And it's really sweet how you vertically sell these things from one lead off into a video game, of course, which didn't even exist really when that song was written, to becoming another launch pad globally. So we were very thankful for them to Rockstar Games, who put us on that. It was great.
A final note, throughout the interview, you said, right place, right time. I was lucky. It was luck that Richard Derbyshire was in the studio. It was luck that this happened. It was luck that that happened. And even when you talk about your kids' truck TV, you mentioned the word, you know, luck, that you were lucky. But isn't luck basically a combination of talent and possibly, in your case, just being a nice guy? Do you know what I mean?
Well, luck, that's very kind.
You know.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it, you know, you can have as much unluck or bad luck as you can have good luck. I'm fairly karmic, as you can tell, you know what I mean? I believe that what you do in good things and the way you deal with people does come back positively or negatively, depending on how you are. Luck, you've got to create it. You've got to have it at the end of the day. I mean, that's what I'm doing with my kids now. You know, they're at university. They're going to just starting to look at what careers they want to go into. And I said, you've got to have the ticket. You've got to get in. You've got to be in the room. So you get your degree or whatever qualifications, your skill set. And then you've got to, obviously, a bit of people skills too. And then a bit of luck will come into you, probably meeting the right person who's the right job, got the right job for you. But you've got to make it. You've got to put yourself about. You know, I think as we often hold ourselves back creatively, I know a lot of creatives do because they haven't got the outgoing spirit, but they might be genius programmers or songwriters, but they don't push the music, they don't know the right people because they haven't put themselves in that position. So you earn your luck, for sure, you make it. We all know this. And it's sometimes as a creative, the going back to the idea of a box that is not really there, you've just perceived it to be there, and that's what holds you back. So if you can just break through it, get out there and make that luck happen, then maybe you're going to be luckier than someone who doesn't.
Brilliant. That's a wonderful final note. And thank you, Marcus, for your contribution to music, which has been very, very important. And I wish you continued success with all your ventures. And hopefully one day I'll see you on stage in the not too distant future.
Well, I hope so, Steve. Well, thank you for asking me. It's been a real pleasure.
And that's it for this interview with Marcus Veer of Living in a Box. I'll see you next Monday with another of Pop's History Makers.
We made USAA insurance to help you save. Take advantage of discounts when you cover your home and your ride. Discover how we're helping members save at usaa.com/bundle. USAA. Restrictions apply.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.